Bronx, even though Williamsburg is a second.
Yeah. Well, I remember the days when Jews all used to drink blended J&B and Shivas and all these things. All right, so we already started the Kuzari that the Rav brings, but I'd like to just read the last two paragraphs again of chapter 6 where the Rav brings the Kuzari, just so we should put ourselves back into the zone, as they say today. So let's just read the last two paragraphs again. My volume is page 48. It's the last two paragraphs of chapter 6. Yeah? Majestic man. Just read these last two paragraphs. Everyone has it? Got it? Majestic man, even when he belongs to the group of homo religiosi, religious men, and feels a distinct need for transcendental experiences, so majestic man, Adam 1, is gratified by his encounter with God within the framework of the cosmic drama. He's happy with God as God relates to world, creator of the world. Since majestic man is incapable of breaking out of the cosmic cycle, as we said, the box of the final frontier being space, etc., he doesn't see anything beyond just space. He cannot interpret his transcendental adventure in anything but cosmic categories. Has to be something that he could still, even Star Trek, as we said, even the most crazy alien movies are still within the world. Therefore, in Genesis chapter 1, the divine name of Elohim, which denotes God being the source of the cosmic dynamics. Now, these words we're about to see in the Kuzari, so pay attention, these words are important. Therefore, the divine name of Elohim, which denotes God being the source of the cosmic dynamics. So this is very important. Philosophically, Elohim is the divine name which is the source of the cosmic dynamics. In Kabbalah and Hasidus, how would you say it differently than being the source of the cosmic dynamics? In Kabbalah and Hasidism, you would say, not that Elohim is the source of the cosmic dynamics, but rather it refers to that aspect of God's light that becomes the cosmic dynamics. And that's not just a difference in semantics. Everyone gets that? Big difference, not just a difference in semantics. In philosophy, we say Elohim would be the source of the cosmic dynamics. In mine, it's 48.
Mine, it's 33. Okay.
Lonely Man of Faith, end of chapter 6. Right. Sorry. Yeah.
33?
What's that? Therefore, the divine name of Elohim, which denotes God being the source of the cosmic dynamics, right? And so that's philosophically, we'd say it's the source of the cosmic dynamics. And in Hasidus and Kabbalah, it's the light of God that becomes the cosmic dynamics. It's that aspect of God's light that becomes the cosmic dynamics. So for Adam 1, in chapter 1, Genesis 1, the name Elohim sufficed to characterize the relationship prevailing between majestic man and his creator, addressing himself to him through the cosmic occurrence. That's Adam 1 within the world, name Elohim. However, covenantal man of faith, craving for a personal and intimate relation with God, could not find it in the cosmic Elohim counter. Right? Man of faith, Adam too, can't find it in Elohim. He can't find it in the name Elohim, because Elohim is God as already becoming part of the world. And he had to shift his transcendental experience to a different level altogether, at which the finite I meets the infinite he face to face. This strange communal relation between man and God is symbolized by the tetragrammaton, the name Yudke Vovke, which therefore appears in the biblical account of Adam the Second, and the language of the Zohar, Mimale Kulaman versus Sover Kulaman. God as he's in his essence, or as we said in the past couple of weeks, the beloved, not just the finger of the beloved. Right? And therefore Adam 2 in Genesis 2 is where the name Yudke Vovke appears. And then in the footnote over here, on the word tetragrammaton, the Rav says, see, this distinction between Elohim and the tetragrammaton, Havaya, was developed in detail by Judah Halevi. So in philosophy, the first place the Rav says that really developed this idea was Judah Halevi, was the Kuzari. He's the first one that developed this idea. In Maimonides, for instance, in Mer Nevuchim, the Rambam discusses different names of Hashem, but very, very dry philosophically, having to do with God's actions. He doesn't get into this distinction between God as God relates to the world and God as an essence. That's in the Kuzari. So now let's take out the Kuzari, the sheet that I gave last week. If anyone needs one, I have an extra one. If anyone doesn't have it, Reuven. You have yours for last week? You said you would remember it.
I have extra.
Okay, so work on with me. Okay, so as I mentioned, this is the beginning. I mentioned last week we started this. This is the beginning of the part four of the Kuzari. This is the very beginning. And this goes on for a whole bunch of chapters. He digresses a little. So what we're going to be doing is just letters 1 to 3 and then 16 and 17. But this is what the Rav's source is. And this is important, obviously, not just to understand Lonely Man of Faith, to understand this distinction that the Rav is making between God as in the cosmic drama and God as he's an essence. It's not just Lonely Man of Faith. It's a fundamental aspect of faith, really, as we'll see in the Kuzari, and we'll talk about it a little more. Let's read the text. The rabbi, Elohim is a term signifying the ruler. That's what the word Elohim means, which is why in Chumash the name Elohim is used very often for other things, right? What is Elohim also used in Chumash? For judges, for din, right? For judges, for any ruler. Elohim is a term signifying ruler or governor of the world. If I allude to the possession of the whole of it, if you say the Elohim of the Olam, then it's ruler of the world. Or it could be and of a portion of the world. If I refer to the powers either of nature or the spheres or a human judge. Elohim could also be a particular thing. The Elohim of, the trees. The Elohim of a particular thing. The judge of this courtroom. You ever wonder that in court, no matter which court it is, it could be the local district circuit court of Arkansas, when the judge steps in, everyone has to stand up. You ever wonder about that? It's like the, huh?
In the local court of Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah, the same thing.
Same thing. Yeah. Some little dinky judge who probably can't spell his name, he walks in with the black robe, Aladav Shtein, everyone has to stand up. It's unbelievable. Like a senator, you don't have to stand up. A judge, you ever wonder why that is? It doesn't have the most smallest circuit judge. Why is that? Because the answer is, according to the letter of the law, if we speak constitutionally, the real ultimate rulers of any land are the judges. The president, officially, the president is only the executive branch. He executes what the law is. The ones that make the law are the legislative branch. But who's the ultimate decider of the law? The judicial branch. The ultimate rule, the real rulers, even though it might not be in fact, in actual, and practically, but lamaisa, in theory, in idea, the judges are the ultimate rulers of the law of the land.
Not in America.
Hold on, it won't make a difference to what Rabbi Yehuda Levi says.
That's for sure not.
But that's incorrect. The executive branch, specifically, and a melech, rules the land.
So I'm not talking about a melech. I was talking in America. Melech is something else. But in this country, the judges at the end of the day have the power to override the president.
No.
The final decision of a law?
The final decision of a law defines law, but they do not have the power to overrule the president. The only people who have the power to overrule the president is the Senate and the House.
Okay, I could be wrong, but in the final...
They don't have the power to overrule the president. They have the power to
define the law.
The president does is unconstitutional.
And then their word is final.
Yeah, however, the president, through executive order...
So that's what I'm saying. In practice, of course the president is in charge, in practice, but in theory, who's the one that ultimately decides the rules of what happens? The ultimate deciders are the judges, is the judicial branch. But let's not get into that, whatever. The point is understood. So the Elohim means, when you have Elohim, the Kuzari is saying of a specific thing, so that's also an Elohim, the Elohim of this particular circuit court. The word has a plural form, and this we spoke last week, the word has a plural form. Why is Elohim in plural? Because it was so used by Gentile idolaters. Now, this is a Chiddush of Yehuda Levi, that the word Elohim comes from the fact that that's how the Gentiles used it.
And why do we use it?
We're going to see in a second. Who believed that every deity was invested with astral and other powers. We spoke about last week that they believed in the different powers, the different spirits that rule different things. And each one is an Elohim. Each of these was called Eloka. They called each one an Eloka, which we would say in English, the Lord of the trees, or the spirit of this. Their united forces were therefore called Elohim. They swore by them, these Gentiles, the pagans, and behaved as if bound to abide by their judgments. These deities were as numerous as are the forces which sway the human body and the universe. You know in Hinduism how many gods there are?
8,000.
thousands of gods, right? And by the pagans, that's what made you a better pagan, was the way you figure out who's the god of this particular force, and each one is an aloka. Like we said last week, each one is a spirit, and we believe, according to Torah, these forces have power. The problem is that you're separating them from God, as he's about to say. Force, when we say that they're the Elohim of the force, is a name for any of the causes of motion.
The Rambam.
Rambam, correct. Motion, all of reality is motion, right? We spoke about that, becoming, going from being to becoming. When we say that everything is motion, if you think about anything that happens in this world is motion. Change, motion. And each one in charge, that everyone in charge of that force is the Eloka. I just have to refer to you to Star Wars, and you all know what it means to have the force with you. When you have forces with you, it means you're in charge of certain powers. Are you looking in or no? Every motion arises from a force of its own to the exclusion of other forces. The spheres of the sun and moon are not subject to one force, but to different ones. Each one has its own force, the sun, the moon, the stars. You know, astrology really has power, according to Torah. According to Torah, astrology is real. There's a star that's in charge of cucumbers. There's another star in charge of watermelons. And each star, really, each one, that's what the astrologers, really, the ones that really knew how to read it, knew what was going to happen. It's this week's Parsha. This week's Parsha, we see that astrology has truth to it. They didn't always know how to read it the best way, right? Ashes Potiphar saw in the astrology that she was going to have children with Yosef, right? So there is real truth to the stars. The problem is, as he's about to say, the Kuzari, is that if you just look at these forces without looking at the source, it's like thinking, these pagans were exactly like a person that walks into a house and says there's the energy that makes the refrigerator makes things cold, and there's the energy that in the oven makes things warm. But they don't chop that there's one electricity that's making it all happen. That was their mistake. But there's a star that makes cucumbers, and there's a star that makes watermelons.
It's a good analogy.
Huh?
It's a good analogy.
Thank you. Let's see further. Here comes what their mistake is. These people did not take into account the prime power, the electricity in the analogy, from which all these forces emanated, because they did not acknowledge its existence. Now, why do you think that's true? Why do you think if they were just looking at the world around them and they were tapping into these spirits and these forces, why would they not acknowledge the existence of a prime power that moves everything else?
They didn't see it that way. What would make someone think that, you know, whatever's growing this is growing that, or whatever?
Right.
In
other words, it wasn't the mindset. It wasn't practical.
Tomato?
Yeah.
It's not so obvious.
It's easier. It's more, right. What was the tsunami have to do with the tomato? Very good. Exactly. A person that never heard of electricity before, why should you think that the same thing that's making the refrigerator make things cold is in the oven making things hot? You don't see that. The sun, you don't feel it. It's not apparent. It's not empirical. They asserted that the sum total of these forces was styled Eloka, just as the sum total of the forces which control the human body was called soul, which is another analogy. You have soul the Kuzari says there were other pagans that admitted the existence of God, but the opposite. They maintained that to serve him was of no use. So this is the opposite. Some say there was no prime power, they just saw the pagan forces. Then there were those that say there is a God, but there's no use having what to do with him. Why not? Because what does he have to do with these forces that are happening in this world? I just need to speak to the star that's making to make our cucumbers grow. What does God care about this specific? I could believe that there is a God, but what does he have to do with all these powers? They separated the two. They considered him too far removed. Where am I holding? They admitted the knowledge of existence of God, but made that to serve him was of no use. They considered him too far removed and exalted of any knowledge of us, much less to care about us. Far from God are such notions. In other words, God chas v'shalom. As a result of their theories, they worship not one being, but many, which they styled Elohim. This is a collective form which comprises all causes equally. So that's Elohim could be a collective form that means the force of all forces. The force, the soul that makes everything else happen. Elohim in our analogy would be electricity. Now, is it true that is God Elohim? Yes. There is the Elohim, the soul that's making all these forces happen. But what did they not chap? What did they not get? Even if we say there's an Elohim, right? But it's Yudke Vavke Hashem Hu Elohim. Meaning there's a personal being beyond all of that. Let's take another analogy. We say, how could there be the same force that makes tsunamis and makes tomatoes grows, right? How could there be a person, we've spoken about this before, that's a soldier, a father, a businessman, an opera singer, a gardener, and goes shopping to buy groceries.
Tomatoes,
right? So you have one person that does all those things. But then there's something that's beyond all those things. And who's that? Frank. We're not confined, we're not defined just by doing those things. That's Yudke Vovke. That's what the Kuzari says. In other words, if I have a relationship with you only as a gardener, what does that tell me about my relationship with you?
Limited.
Very limited. It's limited to one aspect of you. If I have a relationship with you as a boss, it's limited. Even if I have a relationship with you as a friend, depending on which type of friend, of course, but as a friend that we hang out together, we go fishing together, bowling buddies, somebody that I could bowl with, right? How does he say? I can't say the exact, but, whatever, dude, let's just go bowling. Right? You're bowling buddy, right? So at any of these examples...
Big Lebowski?
That was the reference. Any of these examples, as I couldn't exactly say the Shem first, any of these examples, you're relating to aspects, and therefore the truth is, it's not just that it's limited, you're not really relating to the person himself. Think about it for a second. If I relate to you as a gardener, or I relate to you as a... Or, some people relate to a teacher as a teacher, a student as a student. You're not relating to the person themselves. You're relating to one aspect of them.
So you're talking about the difference between Ahava Shetluya B'Davar.
Exactly. And as you could even love a person, I love you because you make the best cookies in Teaneck. I love you because you're the best teacher in Teaneck. I love you because you're the best, you're the best gardener in Teaneck. But I'm not loving you, I'm loving an aspect of you. In fact, even children, why do you love your mom? Because she makes me chocolate milk. That's also not mature. You're not really loving her. A real love is not tli b'davar, but tli b'davar doesn't just mean an external condition, not tali but aspect of you. You love the person. That's intimate. That's what intimacy means. Mm-hmm. Intimacy means essential, deeper than any particular aspect of you. Which in the Pnimizdika way is why, according to Torah, when having relations, there shouldn't be any clothing on. Right? That's a halacha. It's supposed to be without any clothing. It's grounds for divorce. In Pnimiz, Chassidus explains that means an intimate relationship can't be with garments. Garments means specific ways of manifesting. It has to be with the bare bones of who you are. And so the Kuzari is saying Hashem's the same way.
But you're going to say that Yudke Vavke is the essence of
God. Yes. So Yudke Vavke is God's name like Frank. That's exactly the Kuzari's Chiddush. The Kuzari's Chiddush is that, look what he says, let's read it inside. He says, a more exact and more lofty name is to be found in the form known as the Tetragrammaton. This is a proper noun. Who remembers in grammar, what's a proper noun?
Capitalized.
As opposed to saying table.
Frank,
right? Which can only be indicated by attributes, but has no location and was formerly unknown. If he was commonly styled Elohim, the Tetragrammaton was used as a special name, just as if one would say A, B, or a proper name as Reuben or Shimon. Now, Yudke Vavke is like God's name, and that's intimacy with God. Let's talk for a second outside. I want to just speak a little more because this is so fundamental. If I was to say to you anything that you would say, how would you describe God? Anything you could say based on our sources, what would you say? A creator,
always
king,
always will be,
always does, will be, a father,
powerful,
smart, kind, severe, jealous, right? All these things. In the language of Kabbalah,
himself.
So all the names that I said until now in the language of Kabbalah are after Tzimtzum, right? You know that if we speak about God being kind and smart, these are all spheres, these are all attributes after Tzimtzum. Ein Sof is the name that refers to God in his essence, in his intimate essence, right? Ein Sof refers to God in that essence, that's the essence of God. So if you want to relate, so again, just like a child with a mother, you could relate to your mother only as being the one that makes you chocolate milk. But then you could come to a deeper level and loving her as a person. God
if you have a relationship with God as being creator and everything else, and the one that's going to give me, you know, things that I need, that's relating to Elohim in this way. The Kuzari is saying relating to God as is, that's Yukkei Vavkei. That, and that's what the Rav is referring to here, that religious man, that Adam too, only Adam too, it says Yukkei Vavkei. Because only Adam too is not just interested in practicality, in utilitarian God. Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, in Kabbalah, very generally, when you split Elohim and Yudkei Vavkei, Elohim is Mamalek Kol Alman after Tzimtzum, Havai is Ein Sof. There are places, let's say, if you say more specifically, within the 10 spheres, within after Tzimtzum, you would say that Yudkei Vavkei is Rachamim, and Elohim, is Din, and Elkel is Chesed. That, so within the, there's two names, there's two Yudkei Vavkeis, like we know from the Yudkei Vavkeis Rachamim. There's Yudkei Vavkei, which we all know as Rachamim, but that's the one in Atzilus, that's Tiferes. But then there's Yudkei Vavkei that's referring to Ein Sof.
Zuka Zimra then is all Adam 1.
100%. That's what, the 100% Adam 1. We spoke about that. Psuk Dezimra versus Shemone Esrei is Adam 1, Adam 2. 100%. Psuk Dezimra, the introduction to prayer, is having this cosmic drama, having this cosmic experience of God. That's how we first relate to God. Mm-hmm. Seeing the refrigerator in the oven. But then you come to understand that Elohim is the electricity. That's all still in Psukah de Zimra. But then you come to understand that all of that is only a contracted ray of God's light. Shemone Esrei is speaking to God.
Doesn't that's why, by the way, have an Adam 1 component? I mean, you're saying, get rid of the bad guys, I want some health, I want some of this.
So that's a very interesting question. Why Dafkin Shemone Esrei, the highest part of davening, we ask God for our needs? So he's spoken about, but that's...
It's very practical.
Right, so that's so why in Shemone Esrei, which is according to Kabbalah Chassidus, that Shemone Esrei is the highest level.
It's
Yeshurun, right? Oh, you heard the recording already? At that level, so why would we be speaking about our physical needs? So what the Chassidus Sfarim explained, because at that level, physicality is not, we're not speaking about physicality. Again, we're talking about a person that's davening the way he's supposed to. At that level, you see how God is within everything, and therefore the physicality is not a contradiction to Ein Sof. In Psukah de Zimra, when you're trying to meditate and ascend up to God, you can't be thinking about your own stuff. But in Shemone Esrei, when you come to that level of Ein Sof, then the physicality is not a contradiction to him. But let's get back to the Kuzari. So that's the idea. But everyone's in the room between Yudkei Vavkei and Elohim, the intimate proper name of God as opposed to Enim. Let's see further inside. Says the Kuzari, now here comes the question, how can I individualize a being if I'm not able to point to it and can only prove its existence by its actions? What do you think he's asking here? Vimtoimar, how can I individualize a being if I'm not able to point to it and can only prove its existence by its actions?
Well, if every time you try to point and say God is a creator, you're like, no, he's bigger than the creator, and no, then he's a destroyer, he's this, and everything you say is not enough, then you're left with nothing. You can't...
Right, let's take the analogy further. Let's say when somebody eventually figured out electricity. You eventually figured out there's electricity, that's what's making everything, all the different things happen, right? But now if I say to you, electricity is still Elohim, right? Why is electricity still Elohim? Because like we said, it's the sum total of all the Elokas. It's the sum total of all the forces, right? So now what I'm going to say to you, okay, now tell me about who made the electricity. Infer from electricity who made the electricity. Infer from a building, tell me about who the person is that made the building. Not just the fact that he knew how to build and had a beautiful taste. Tell me about the person himself. What would you say? You can't. You can't infer if A produced B, yeah? What aspect of A can you know if you know B?
None.
Only that part of A that it has the potential to be B, but not A. You don't know A as is. You know that A could make B, but you don't know anything about A, Gesundheit. Yeah. So he's asking over here, if you could only infer about electricity, and I could, there's someone that made electricity, but what else do you know about him? Nothing. This, by the way, if you look, it's interesting, in Encyclopedia Talmudis, you know the set? You know, are you familiar with Encyclopedia Talmudis from Rav Zevin? You ever heard of it? Encyclopedia Talmudis, no. the Talmudic Encyclopedia,
yellow one,
they've been working on it for about 40 years, they're up to like volume 30-something, and they're only up to like letter Lamed or something. It's an encyclopedia of the whole, and it's all from the Gemara. There's only one place I found so far, but I'd be happy to hear if I'm wrong, one place I find where he actually quotes from Chassidus, Rav Zevin, and that's in Emunah.
In the volume about Emuna, he actually quotes from the Tzemach Tzedek in Amonis Alakuz and Derech Mitzvasecha, because it's so fundamental. Well, the Tzemach Tzedek explains, therefore, anything we could know about God is all not faith in God. It's all knowledge of God. Mm-hmm. Tell me why this sentence makes...
Say that again. Excuse me?
Anything we could know about God, anything we could be aware of God, rationally, is not Emuna. It's Yediyas Hashem.
Because that's knowing.
Exactly. It's things that we could infer. In fact, the this. Tell me why this sentence makes no sense. You tell me why this sentence makes no sense. And even though, again, a lot of philosophers would disagree. I believe that God exists because there's a world, so there must be somebody that created it. I believe that there's a God because there's a world, there must be a God that created it.
That doesn't follow logically.
Why?
Just because something exists does not mean there's a creator.
Well, let's say even though, I'm not getting now into the cosmological proof whether it's valid or not. We'll speak about that mitzvah shem later. But right now, I want to just focus on the phraseology of the sentence. I believe there's a God because since there's a world, there must be. Let's say you do believe in the cosmological proof.
I know.
Right. Why? Because the phrase, there's a world, there must be a God that created it, is that, what is that? That's a postulate. That's a logical inference. So the word belief doesn't make sense over there. It wouldn't make sense to say belief. That's a rational statement. Whether you agree it's valid or not is beyond the point. So the Tzemach Tzedek says anything you could use your mind to perceive is not emuna. It's not emuna. It's all Yediyas Hashem. So what's emuna? You know what emuna is? If I say to you, God is infinitely kind, infinitely wise, infinitely powerful. Is that Emunah or Yediyah? It's Yediyah. Tzemach Tzedek says it's all Yediyah. Because it's all aspects of God that I can understand. We're not talking about whether you could prove it or not. Don't make a mistake. Listen again, we're not talking about whether you could prove it. That's not an interest in me right now. When you're assuming that you recognize these things, those things are all things you could perceive. So if I'm saying that infinitely powerful, infinitely kind, infinitely great, are all after God contract himself, they're all after Tzimtzum. So then I said to you, so what is God? That's Emuna. Emuna is the belief that God is beyond anything I could perceive. In the language of the Alter Rebbe and the Tzemach Tzedek, Das is in Mamali Kol Alman, in Elokim, Das. Emuna is in Sov Kol Alman Yudke Vavke. Anything that I could perceive, and even if I say infinite power, now I don't know what infinite power is, but I know what power is, and I'm saying it's infinite of it. But it's still something. It's what the Rambam called negative Yediyas Hashlila, negative theology, negative. How did he refer to negative attributes? Right, negative attributes is still a type of knowing. I know that he's beyond what I know. He's infinitely powerful, but it's still some type of power. None of that is what God is. Those are all just ways he manifests. So what is he? That's Emunah. And the truth is...
What is he? That's Emunah?
What is he really? I don't know.
And that's the Emunah.
That's the Emunah. To believe that anything that I know, that's not yet Emunah. Emunah is beyond all of that. That's Yudke Vavke.
Can you argue the exact opposite? Couldn't you argue the exact opposite?
That what?
That... There is no knowledge of God. It all comes down to faith. I'm using English terms for the same.
Again, Lenny, I said very carefully. I'm not talking about now whether I'm not talking about people that believe. Right. I'm talking about people that are religious.
They're religious. You mean so they have a fundamental belief?
No, I'm not talking about whether things can be proven or not. No, I'm talking about people that recognize God. Now, within the aspect of
recognition of God means you have that basic initial faith. That there is a God.
Okay.
So you're like already in the definitions of believing that there's a God.
So when you say believing there's a God, what is believing in God?
As
why?
Opposed to knowing there's a God.
Why?
Because all these other things can be, one could explain other ways other than there being a God.
So when you say believing there's a God, is there a why here or just that you.
No.
No why?
Just a belief.
Just a belief for no reason.
That's
emuna. Also emuna.
That's emuna.
That's 100% emuna.
That is emuna.
That's emuna, but listen to this. You ready? In Chassidus, that's called emuna that's lower than das.
Okay.
What I was talking about was emunah that's beyond das.
Which is what?
It's in
Chassidus. What's the difference between what he just said and emunah that's above?
Emunah, though, what Lenny's talking about, which we're going to learn, we're going to also see from the Rav in a second, is the essential feeling that before my mind starts working, in Chassidus, it's what happens by Maida Ani. There's emunah of Maida Ani, then Das is Zimran Kriyashma, and then Shemoneh Esrei is emunah above, which means like this. The initial fact that I feel there's a God. No, not because there's a world, whatever. It's just a feeling the soul has that I feel there's a higher, I feel that there's an ultimate being without any mind working at all. That's the initial emunah. Shalamata mitam v'das. That's below. That's the first. The Maidani, I wake up. God exists. Maidani lefanecha. Who, what, when? I feel that God exists.
And above.
So then, now I start saying, okay, now what is this God? So I could prove. I try to work on. I think about that. There's logical things. There's a world. He created it. He's within the world. He's the force within everything. He's making the tsunamis and the tomatoes. Every time water goes down. Gravity, it's Hashem making the water go down. He's making the leaves. I meditate everything. I look at him in the world around me, and I meditate Psukah Dezimra, how he's within the stars and the moon and everything around me. That's all das. That's all meditating. And das, v'yadata yemeshuvayis levavecha, I'm meditating. And then I'm meditating that all of this is only a ray of his light, and he's infinitely powerful, and that the Milky Way is only a ray of his light, and that the solar system is nothing. He's a speck of dust, and he's infinitely above that. And then I meditate that he's infinitely greater than that, and it's only a speck of his dust. That's all of my knowledge, and then my positive knowledge is how he's within the world. My negative knowledge is that he's beyond all of that. And then I realize that all of that is how my mind is perceiving him within, and my mind is perceiving his transcendence. But then I realize that all of that is still only a ray of what he is. That's not him. That's all just a ray of his light. It's
and
all.
That, and that is.
Wait,
and still within the Elkos.
Still within das, right? And it's all within. I'm saying it's all. And then I saw that all of that. It's like saying Bill Gates is rich because he could afford to buy the most expensive type of wine that there is. That's you haven't at all captured what he is. None of that is really what. None of this is really what God is. It's only a ray of him. So what's he? That's then bittul. No, I nullify my mind and say, emuna, beyond anything that I could see, I could understand.
So it's from the negative.
It's by transcending and using my mind as much as you can, and then going beyond that. That's the two steps. That's emuna before using my mind, and emuna after using my mind.
Which is a null, which is a nothing, which is a basically saying it's beyond what I can think of.
That's right. Right. Totally. It's beyond, my mind doesn't work over there.
That's Chanukah.
And that's Chanukah. That's exactly the eight. That's exactly Chanukah. Right. Chanukah is that's what I always say. Listen to this. I'm going to say something because this is very important. I think we talked about this Friday night. So this is so important, especially for all of us at this table. We like philosophy, yeah? It used to bother me to no end. Everyone comes along, you know, and I hung out by Hasidic people. Comes along Chanukah, and it says, Choshech zu Yavan, right? By the Dalet Golias, the four exiles, right? Toyu v'voyu is madai dub. Choshech zu Yavan. And everyone greases darkness. Chazal. And everyone, the whole Chanukah is talking about Choshech, Yavan is darkness, Yavan greases darkness, greases darkness. And Chanukah was the Chashmonaim overcame the Greeks and turned and came to light. And I was about Greek greases darkness, Aristotle is darkness. Socrates and Plato darkness, right? The entire civilization of the world comes from Greece and then Rome. You're going to call that darkness? What did the Rambam think to himself when he learned Chazal Choshech zu Yavan? The whole Mar Nevuchim is based on Aristotelian philosophy. Pasha darkness. Darkness. Kacha. Darkness. Until I chop, the pshat's like this. The pshat is, vis-a-vis Ein Sof, the greatest human intellect that there could be is darkness. Let me ask you a question. Let's say I will sit here for 5,000 years and explain to this bottle of Turkey Hill iced tea all the secrets of Torah. Will it understand it? No. Why not? Because this can never comprehend intellect. That's how our... knows this compared to our brains is darkness. Our brains compared to God is darkness. Yavan
within the realm of reality, within the box of the cosmic reality, Yavan is the ultimate light. Nobody should think Chazal weren't stupid. Chazal knew that Yavan, the Greece, was the ultimate light within the realm of human perfection. There was never, there was never a society that was so innovative as Greece in everything, all of history. There are those I might argue, but all of history and all philosophy are all footnotes to what the Greeks taught us. And continuation of it. But then came the Chashmonaim and said exactly what Jonathan said, but there's an eight. That's all the seven. There's above that. Vis-a-vis God, all of that is Chesh. Compared to God, that's Chesh. That's the Pshat. And so that's the Pshat, that everything, so, and that's Emunah, and that's Emunah. Mm-hmm. That's Emunah, Emunah is the Emunah that's above Das. That after I use my mind as much as I can, then I say, then there's God. What's God? I don't know. And the truth is, you ready for, let's go one step deeper. The truth is, if we'll say the same thing, that's what Reb Tzadok HaKohen says, that just like there's a mitzvah to believe in God, there's a mitzvah to believe in yourself. Reb Tzadok writes in Sikhs HaTzadok, Kishem Yesh Chayv Lahamin Ba'Kadosh Baruch Hu, Chayv Lahamin Ba'atzmai. Just like you have to have a moon in God, you have to believe in yourself. Based on what we're learning now, we understand 100% what that means. If I'm going to ask you, what are you really? Who is the real you? I don't know. But I have a munah. I have a munah that I have a neshama that's one with Hashem. And I don't know what that is. But I have a munah that it's greater than anything that I'm aware of. That's a munah. That's the pshat. That's, and that's what the Kuzari is talking about over here. And that's what the Rav means. That's what Adam too is looking for in God. That's why he needs the name Yudke Vavke. That's Mamish Chanukah. It's Mamish exactly. That's the meaning of Chanukah. Yep. Let's go weiter. So now that's all the question of the Kuzari. So he says, so how can I individualize a being? So how could I know? So now the question becomes, how could I have this intimate relationship with the Ein Sof, with God in his essence? How do I get there? If I'm not able to point to it and can only prove its existence by its actions. Answers the Kuzari, it can be designated by prophetic or visionary means. Exactly what the Rav said. Do you see how this is exactly what the Rav said? Remember, what's he answering here? What's the answer over here? You can't attain it. What's the only way you could get to it? He speaks to you. Let's read it inside, then we'll see it in the Rav. It can be designated by prophetic or visionary means, where he actually talks about something else. But that's what did the Rav say? Let's read it inside. Abraham, the knight of faith, according to our tradition, sought and discovered God in the starlit heavens of Mesopotamia. Yet, he felt an intense loneliness and could not find solace in the silent companionship of God, whose image was reflected in the boundless stretches of the cosmos. Only when he met God on earth, as father, brother, and friend, did he feel redeemed. Right? And that's what the Rav is going to say, that Hashem had to reveal himself to him. He had to speak to Abraham. It was only when Hashem actually spoke to him and revealed himself to him that Avram was able to get to a relationship with Hashem.
Let's see. How he discovered God. That was much later.
No, you give up game. Not Elohim. He discovered the electricity. Avram discovered the Elohim, the electricity. But Yud Kevavke was Vayera Elof Hashem. It's always from a prophetic revelation from above. By us, it's through Emunah. By them, it's by God revealing Himself. Look inside. Demonstration can lead astray. You know what he means here by demonstration? Here he means by logic. By intellectual, back in the Kuzari. Demonstration, neither's intellectual seeking, can lead astray. Demonstration was the mother of heresy and destructive ideas. What was it if not the wish to demonstrate that led the dualists to assume two eternal causes? Why did demonstration cause the dualists to assume two eternal causes? Because if you're trying to use pure logic and intellect, then how could the same God that make a sunset make also a cancer ward? If you're using demonstration, which is the word he's using for intellectually, if you're just trying to understand intellectually, it can't be the same God makes two different things. And what led materialists to teach that the sphere was not only eternal, but its own primary cause, as well as that of other matter? The worshippers of fire and sun are but the result of the desire to demonstrate. Demonstrating means by to understand, those that just want to understand. There are differences in the ways of demonstration, of which some are more extended than others. There are different levels of philosophy, of just trying to philosophize and understand by philosophizing. Those who go to the utmost length are the philosophers, and the ways of their arguments lead them to teach of a supreme being which neither benefits nor injures. Philosophically, you all know, philosophically, Almost all the philosophers said that there's a God. But at the same level, almost all philosophers say that you can't have a personal relationship with God, because that makes no sense logically. If you just demonstrate the electricity, let's say you came down to send electricity. Does the electricity care what the refrigerator is doing? Let's say you're a container of milk in the fridge. You're a container of the milk in the fridge. Or you're a piece of toast in the oven. Do you think electricity cares what happens to the toast? No. Logically, one has nothing, one has to do the other. So the Khazar is saying, demonstration, if you don't have a revelation from above, your mind is never going to get you to Havayat, get you Elikim, but not Yud Kei Vav Kei. And again, and in our life, as we said before, it's Emunah. Look inside. But those who go to Thomas think that the philosophers and the ways of the arguments lead them to teach of a supreme being which neither benefits nor injures and knows nothing of our prayers, offerings, obedience, or disobedience, and that the world is as eternal as he himself, like Plato says. None of them applies a distinct proper name to God. That's why the philosophers don't name God. They don't give him a name. Except he who hears his address, command, or prohibition, approval for obedience and reproof for disobedience. He bestows in him some name as a designation for him who spoke to him, and he's convinced that he is the creator of the world from naught. The first man would never have known God if he had not addressed, rewarded, and punished him, and not created Eve from one of his ribs. And if God didn't reveal himself to Adam, he wouldn't have known him. Without this, he would have been satisfied with the name Elohim, neither perceiving what God was, nor whether he was a unity or a many, whether he was cognizant of individuals or not. Yeah, everyone following the train of thought? Cain and Havel were made acquainted with the nature of his being by communications of their father, as well as by prophetic intuition. Then Noach, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Moshe, and the prophets called him intuitively Lord, as also did the people, having been taught by a tradition that his influence and guidance were with men. Had to be revelation from above, and that's what the Rav is saying. That's in the Rav's writings, it's what's known as the community of faith. Now, one more thing with Stephen Khuzari, because this next thing is probably the most famous. These two next paragraphs are probably the most famous sentence of paragraphs from the Khuzari. Says the Khuzari, now, and you see it skips, we just read paragraph 3, this is now 16. Look, now I understand the difference between Elohim and Hashem, and I see how far the God of Abraham is different than that of Aristotle. I'm sure you've all heard of that, right? That's the famous Khuzari that differentiates between the God of Abraham and the God of Aristotle. The Rav quotes this all the time. But it's mamash everything we just spoke about.
When he says Adnas, he's talking about
Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei.
Yeah, right? But we all see now why that's in the God of Aristotle is what Adam 1 is able to come to, and the God of Abram is through Adam 2. Man, now listen, this is beautiful. This is really beautiful. Man yearns for Hashem as a matter of love, taste, and conviction, while attachment to Elohim is the result of speculation. You understand? That's a beautiful sentence. Get that again. Man yearns for Hashem as a matter of love, taste, and conviction, while attachment to Elohim is a result of speculation.
Speculation is so ephemeral.
What do you mean?
It's like so wispy for such a deep commitment.
He says speculation doesn't mean like we in today's parlance we would say speculation.
Thinking, logic.
He means logic. Speculative philosophy.
To search.
Okay, so but even if you say searching, it's
in a logical.
Adam one. So this is not doubt.
Ask me one of those. What?
Speculation is not.
No.
Another word for doubt.
No.
Speculation. Yeah,
it's not rational discourse.
Rational discourse. No. This is a very bad translation. Speculation here it means rational discourse.
Part one and two.
But here's my question. As a matter,
speculation over here means like speculative philosophy. You ever heard the term speculative philosophy?
Yeah, the English translation of Khazar.
Why, you want to see another translation?
Maybe
it's
a better word.
I only have the Hebrew.
Let's see what he says in the Hebrew. Can you give me the Hebrew?
Right, one,
right behind you, Steve. The white one with red letters.
But then,
one up. They're right there where your finger is. Yep. Next to it. No, one more. Yep, that's it.
As a matter of practicality, then, if rational discourse is not going to get you there, and it turns out that what is going to get you there is
revelation,
is prophetic or visionary means, that means the ball is in Hashem's court. I mean, he's got to do this. There's nothing I could, because I'm stuck with just thinking. Right, I don't know how to do anything else.
And now, and you're saying for what we now use is Emunah.
But not even what we use is Emunah. This is, Hashem, if you want to show me some vision to give me relationship,
so that's what Torah is. That Torah is a continuation of that prophetic revelation.
But Torah is something that we still can... We have to approach with a certain rational discourse. Or we just have to wait for like,
Listen. He's saying over here that once was revealed to the prophets and everything what God is, we now know that God is beyond Elohim. And we have the revelation in Torah now. He doesn't mean to say that God has to tap everyone on the shoulder. He means to say that until he revealed it to Adam, to Avram, to Moshe, we wouldn't be able to know the source of the electricity. Now that it's in Torah, we now continue that covenantal community that Abraham began. Do you have the word? You find it, John? Hegyoni. Hegyoni. Yeah, Hegyoni means higoyim, means logic. So that's what he means to say. Let's read it again. Man yearns for Hashem as a matter of love, taste, and conviction, while attachment to Elohim is a result of logic, hegayon. Now listen how beautiful. A feeling of the former, meaning if you feel Hashem, God, the intimate God, invites its votaries, it's quite a word, those that subscribe to it, I guess, to give their life for His sake and prefer death to His absence. When you have that intimate relationship with God, you prefer death to God's absence. You'd give your life for Him. Speculation, logic, philosophy, however, makes veneration only a necessity as long as it entails no harm, but bears no pain for its sake. You know, the Hungarians, which, I used to be Munkácsa Chassid once upon a time, and I used to be very into that school of thought, or... I mean, I don't know how much thought, but whatever. But that school, and
you realize you're recording this.
They're all holy people, whatever. But anyway, so and even the B'nai Yisrael was a very holy sage, but he also was very Hungarian in that way. So when they all constantly diss philosophy, always they're dissing philosophy, right? So they always bring the famous thing from the Chassid Yaivetz. You ever heard of the Chassid Yaivetz? Chassid Yaivetz was alive at the time of the expulsion from Spain in 1492. Not the Yaivetz that was Rabbi Yaakov Emden. It's called the Chassid Yaivetz. And all the Hungarians always bring that he saw an Edus, a testimony, that during the 1492 or during the Inquisition, for the years preceding that, those, you know, at that time Spain was the capital of philosophy, right? They were all into philosophy. He says those that were involved in philosophy converted to Catholicism. And the simple people, the women and the children, gave their lives for God. And he says that's what happened. He says that was his testimony, that those, the biggest philosophers, converted, and those that had the simple faith gave their life for Hashem. Now, what would you say to that? I mean, he's saying an Eidus.
I believe it.
I believe it too. He's saying it happened. We all understand, anyone that bases things only on philosophy is not going to daven three times a day. Impossible. Mm-hmm. And if you're really hungry at an airport, you'll get one of those good-smelling Danishes. Because you know what the brain is capable of convincing you? The brain could convince you a lot, but that the brain should mamish, you know, there's a famous, they say, there was a Professor Fleming in England, I think in Cambridge, and he was a professor of ethics, and he was quote once doing something very unethical. And he was fired. And his response was that you didn't fire the geometry professor for not being a triangle. The brain could understand a lot of different things, right? Okay, say it. You convinced me rationally. So what? You know what I'm saying? So if your whole religion is based on only philosophy, it's going to be very cold. But you have to have emunah. Have emunah. It doesn't mean you shouldn't learn philosophy. You have to. Emunah has to be the and everyone, you know, if you don't have emunah at all, then why bother? You agree, right?
I agree. I mean,
you can't, with philosophy by itself, I mean, nothing, and we're going to speak also, Mitzvah, what the Rebbe is going to say in this big footnote, nothing can be proven philosophically. The Rebbe is going to say in this big footnote, which we're going to, Mitzvah, start tonight, the Rebbe is going to say that with philosophy by itself, logic cannot prove anything at all. And even if you have a great philosophical proof, it's not going to make you get up off your couch and do something.
But the converse of it is, yeah. Rambam states, you cannot be a full Jew without philosophy.
That's right. Because the idea is that the second step has to be das. It has to be the emunah that comes first. Mm-hmm. And then to use das, which is taka why I started learning philosophy, etc. But yeah, there has to be the das also, because otherwise you're just stam, you remain a simple child. Let's read further. Speculation, however, makes veneration only necessity as long as it entails no harm, but bears no pain for its sake. I would therefore excuse Aristotle for thinking lightly about the observation of the law, since he doubts whether God has any cognizance of it. So it makes sense why Aristotle says it makes no sense to keep laws. God doesn't know about it. Let's just read this quickly, and the rabbi responds, Abram bore his burden honestly. I don't know the word honestly is. I think he means bitmimus. He probably means like with fulfilling. The life in Rakazdim, immigration, circumcision, the removal of Ishmael, and the distress of the sacrifice of Yitzhak, because his share of the divine influence had come to him through love, not through speculation. He observed that not the smallest detail could escape God, that he was quickly rewarded for his piety and guided in the right path to such an extent that he did everything in the order dictated by God. How could he do otherwise than deprecate his former speculation? The sages explain the verse, Vayoytze oyse achutza. Remember, God took Abraham out. What did he take him out of? Astrology. He took him out of the cosmos. As meaning, give up the horoscopy, that is to say, command him to leave his speculative researches into the stars and other matters, and to follow faithfully the object of inclination, as it is written, Tamru, taste and see that the Lord is good. In this last sentence, I'm not sure that I agree with either. Hashem is therefore called rightly the God of Israel, because this view is not found among Gentiles. I don't know if that's true today. Maybe that was true at the time of the Khuzari, but I certainly would not think that's true of today's Gentiles. But anyway, the point is understood. Yeah? Clear? We all got this idea of the Khuzari? Mm-hmm. Let's see inside. Let's see the Rav's footnote further. Let's read inside. I know I said to bring the halachic man, but I'm going to get to Mitzvah next week. I'm not going to have time to get to it today. We'll get to it next week. But let's now read. Go back into Lonely Man of Faith. Let's start this footnote, which is a very important footnote, and I'm going to spend some time on it. We'll start this week and continue next week. Okay. Says the Rav, we did the next footnote, the one after the Khuzari, you see it? The footnote that begins, Bracious Rabbah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's start. I intentionally use the term cosmic instead of cosmological. Now, what's he referring to when he says I use the term cosmic instead of cosmological? He's referring to the paragraph that we read already today. Let's read it again. You see the paragraph that begins, Majestic Man? See it? Yeah? Going back to the paragraph, the two paragraphs. Majestic man, even when he belongs to the group of religious men and feels a distinct need for transcendental experiences, is gratified by his encounter with God within the framework of the cosmic drama. Since majestic man is incapable of breaking out of the cosmic cycle, right? That he keeps using it. Therefore, the divine name of Elohim, which denotes God being the source of the cosmic dynamics. He keeps speaking as Elohim being cosmic. Right? Well, let's look at the last paragraph, the paragraph that begins, however. See it? Last paragraph. However, covenantal man of faith, craving for a personal intimate relation with God, could not find it in the cosmic Elohim encounter. Right? What does cosmic mean?
Natural order.
Natural order within the world.
Nature.
Experience, yeah? Says the footnote, says the Rav, I intentionally use the term cosmic instead of cosmological. This, by the way, this footnote is one of the most important things that the Rav wrote, and we're going to see this, Rabbi. You know this guy, Shubert Spiro? You know who he is? What does cosmological mean? You know what cosmological means? Cosmological is a term that refers to one of the famous proofs of the existence of God. There are three famous proofs of the existence of God. Cosmological, ontological, and teleological. Cosmological means I infer, I prove God's existence from the fact that there's a world. From the fact that there's something, must be something created it. Ontological existence is the fact that there's being. There must be a source of being. There must be, and teleological is that there's order to everything. These are the proofs, the famous classic proofs for God's existence. So cosmological, what the Rav is saying is now, is that when I'm talking about the first level of Adam 1, I don't mean he's having a cosmological experience of God. I'm saying he's having a cosmic experience of God. Which means what the Rav is saying is that even Adam 1, the Rav is saying, I don't mean that he comes to Elohim through speculation, through the proofs that the Khuzari just dissed. Even Adam 1, the Rav is so completely rejecting philosophical proofs for the existence of God that he's saying, even in Adam 1, I don't mean he is having a cosmological experience. I mean he's having a cosmic experience. He's experiencing God. He's not proving. Proofs, the Rav says, are absolutely worthless. They'll get you nowhere. Even Adam 1, I don't mean to say that he's proven God through the world. Oh, there's a world, must be there's a God that exists. No, he's really experiencing God within the world. He's having a Psuga de Zimra experience. He's feeling God in the sunset. That's still Adam 1. So the Rav is saying, feeling God in the sunset, feeling God hug you as your children are hugging you, is a cosmic experience of God. Not a cosmological is dry, and the Rav is going to say meaningless.
So can you say that the Rav is saying that proof of God, as you've said, cannot be proved? In other words, God cannot be proved. He can only be experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, the Rav is going to, and we're going to see very, and this is a very important idea of the Rav, which we're going to learn this mitzvah, we're going to get to it, I don't know if we'll get to it this week, this book. But he has a beautiful, you have this book from Shubit Shapiro? Aspects of the Rav's Philosophy of Judaism. It's a very good book, and there's a whole chapter about this. This is a phenomenal aspect of the Rav's philosophy. The Rav, who was a philosopher par excellence, never got involved in scholastic proofs. And the quote-unquote classic proofs for God, he completely disses them, here and in halachic mind. Look what he says, look inside. I intentionally use the term cosmic instead of cosmological. While one may speak of the cosmic confrontation of man and God as an experiential reality, it is hard to speak of a cosmological experience. Hear what he's saying? Again, while one may speak of the cosmic confrontation of man and God as an experiential reality, it is hard to speak of a cosmological experience. You can't experience a piece of paper. When you feel God in the cosmos, that's an experience. When you feel God in a sunset, that's an experience. You're experiencing God. You can't have a cosmological experience. The best philosophical proofs, the best, if it's just logic, dry logic, is not an experience of God. It's an unbelievable thing. When God is apprehended in reality, it is an experience. When God is comprehended through reality, it is just an intellectual performance. This is incredible. And this is even in Adam 1, you see?
It's just the midos. You're just experiencing the house that he built.
Yeah.
You're not
with
the creator.
Well, no, but wait, what do you mean? No, the house that he built, if you're experiencing the sunset, that's a cosmic mm-hmm. experience.
But to logically say that that's, I mean, you can never say that's God. So therefore, but secondly,
if you want to use the mushal that you're saying, if you're sitting in a, let's use the mushal saying, if you're sitting in a classroom learning about architecture, and you're shown a book with pictures of a most beautiful house, and lots of pictures of the book of the most beautiful house, and now you know that this architect, whose name is Jan Sykes, because their name is always Jan or some Danish name, right? So this architect, Jan Sykes, that made this beautiful house that you've seen pictures of, you now know he's an unbelievable architect, right? What happens when you actually go in that house and live in it? Then you've experienced his talent. Right? So living in the house is experiencing the talent of the architect. Seeing pictures of it is not an experience. So if you're proving the existence of God, that's cosmological. If you're living in the world and feeling everything and feeling the presence of God within everything, that's cosmic experience. That's experiencing God. That's just not, how is he saying? That's experiencing God in reality, not just an intellectual performance.
Experiencing but not knowing.
What?
Experiencing but not knowing.
No, it's deeper than knowing. I'm saying this is what the Rav is saying is the cosmic experience.
No, but that's not. It doesn't work. Because
you don't know the architect.
No. You don't, Nachum, you don't know the essence of who they are.
Right.
Adam, too, doesn't care about the fact that he's an architect at all. He just wants Jan. We're talking within Adam 1. What the Rav is saying is that Adam 1 knows God through the world, not through proofs.
maybe you can say that experience living in that house is the point at which finite meets infinity. That's the closest a human being can get
to
das.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yes.
To
that type of knowing here, when I keep saying...
It's experiential.
Yes, experiential knowing. Right. Knowing of your, as Rabbi Spiro, whoever
that's
this...
The, according to the Rav, that right. seems to be the only way...
That's the only way.
One,
yeah.
one can
by,
know God.
By definition, the way we've built it up.
Yeah, that's the way you know God. And here when we say no, I don't mean... We're differentiating between logical speculation and knowing. That's why das, in the biblical sense, to know means to be connected, right? Knowing, when you know someone, you know, what's the difference between, I'll give the example, if I already brought that up. What's the difference between reading a shidduch profile? Right?
Sorry.
You step right there.
And actually having a really good 5-hour, deep, intimate date. The shidduch profile. Huh?
$20.
$20? When was the last time you dated? $20.
In those days.
Yeah, $20. I don't think even going to a bar will cost you more than $20 these days just to get around the drinks. Anyway, but you understand the shidduch profile is cosmological, is just speculating that there's an existence of a God and blah, 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 blah. But when you go on a date, you get to know someone. In the biblical sense, depending on from you are, but getting to know someone, that's when you intimately get to know the person, right? So that's what the Rav is saying. A cosmic experience of God is getting to know him through the world.
Experiential.
That's experiential, and that's beautiful. It's and that's, you should know, in epistemology. You know what epistemology means? The philosophy of the mind, the way the mind works. What Rabbi Spear, we're going to read next week, and what the Rav is saying in this footnote is that the Rav, very much in epistemology, subscribed to phenomenological approach as opposed to dry epistemology. In other words, the way my mind works could be with just mathematic equations. There's a world, must be God exists, and these types of proofs, which are meaningless and dry, or phenomenology is a consciousness of experience. And so that's what the Rav is saying. Let's read that. I know it's already late. What time is it? Let's just read this quickly, and I want to do it again next week, but let's read it quickly. We'll go back. Therefore, one must not equate the cosmic experience, no matter how inadequate it is, even though it's only Adam 1, with Judah Halevi's God of Aristotle. The Rav says, I'm not saying the cosmic experience is not the God of Aristotle. As we mentioned in the text, the cosmic experience is part of the patriarchal tradition. That's how Abraham came to know God. The halacha has granted full recognition to this experience, which is reflected in many of our benedictions. That's beautiful. How is the cosmic experience reflected in many of our benedictions?
Brachas.
Brachas on what?
On
Maaseh Bereishis, on thunder, on lightning, on mountains, on hills, on rainbows. That means encountering God in the cosmic experience. The trouble with all rational demonstrations of the existence of God, with which the history of philosophy abounds, consists in their being exactly what they were meant to be by those who formulated them. Abstract, logical demonstrations, divorced from the living, primal experiences in which these demonstrations are rooted. They're just paper. They're a shidduch profile. For instance, the cosmic experience was transformed into a cosmological proof. The ontic experience, which means, ontic experience means the feeling of being, that you feel in your kishkas arayin. In your kishkas you feel ontic. You feel that there's being, there's reality. Was transformed into an ontological proof. Oh, must be that there's a being, that pa-pa-pa. Instead of stating that the most elementary existential awareness as subjective I exist, and an objective the world around me exists awareness, is unattainable as long as the ultimate reality of God is not part of this awareness, which I'll get back to the sentence next week, the theologians engage in formal postulating and deducing an experiential vacuum. It was just a vacuum, not experience, just making up postulates. And because of this, they expose themselves to Hume's and Kant's biting criticism. That's why Hume and Kant completely destroyed these ideas. The logical categories are applicable only within the limits of the human scientific experience. And here's one of the most famous sentences from the book. Does the loving bride, in the embrace of her beloved, ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that God exists? So asked Kierkegaard sarcastically when told that the Anselm of Canterbury, the father of the very abstract and complex ontological proof, spent many days in prayer and supplication that he presented with rational evidence of the existence of God. If you're hugging him and praying to him, why do you need to prove that he exists? And so this is very much the Rav's epistemology, really phenomenology, that God is something that could only be experienced. If you're looking for proof of God, you're wasting your time. And this is why if anyone ever says to you, prove to me God exists, you know what you should answer them? Prove to me philosophically that you exist. Prove to me philosophically that the world exists. And after Hume and Kant, that's impossible. Hume and Kant destroyed any way of proving that anything exists. Kal v'chomer God. So at the end of the day, how do you know God exists? Like you said, we feel him. Like I feel that I exist. I feel that there's this reality. And this is a big chiddush of the Rav. We're going to learn this week. If you have this book, you could take a look. We're going to do some paragraphs from it. It's from chapter 6 called Belief in God. About the Rav's way of approaching about the moon. So we'll continue next week.
It's interesting. Yeah. The example you gave of the house and
yeah.
the builder
yeah.
is exactly the reason why people say Ayn Rand actually believed there was a God because of her book, The Fountain.
Really? Because she had that much emunah in architecture, in knowing about a person.
No, what she did was, if you haven't read it, but it's about an architect.
I know, of architecture, modern architecture.
So
yeah.
he said you could not understand what I build until you live in the house.
This is perfect before Hanukkah. This is mamash, like you said. This is exactly what Hanukkah is all about.
You go to the Maharals, you know, that's
yeah.
You really
his other book was one of my first.
Stop making that sound.
Did you stop? You turned it back
on. No, I turned it off. Right. And then I just stopped and I turned it back on. What did you say?
The other book that you wrote.
Rabbi Spear? Morality and Jerusalem. Yeah.
That was my first book that got me.
Really?
Yeah.